Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Steve Naive. It occurred to me he's been playing keyboards for Elvis Costello for almost just a couple years shy of 50 years. And I've been a huge Elvis Costello fan since I was a teenager, so I had a million questions. I also had a million questions I couldn't ask Steve, just didn't have the time. So I sort of had to narrow down and just touch on, I guess, what I thought you listeners would be interested. So hopefully I got it right, and perhaps there'll be a part two, because after talking to him, I had just as many questions as when I started. It seems like he is coming to the East Coast of the United States of America for the About Love tour. New album is called About Love. Information on tour and album is at stevenaive.com. He's playing, interestingly, a radio taping at Stony Brook, New York, in Long Island. And then he's got two residences at Chez Marie in Shelter Island. Shelter Island is a teeny little island between the North and South Fork of Long Island. I guess that might be considered the Hamptons. Absolutely gorgeous little place, Shelter Island. I highly recommend, if you can get out there. You have to take a ferry to get there. I guess if you've got your own yacht, that's fine. Or you could swim, I suppose. But he's playing there in July and in August for a couple nights each. So that just sounds amazing. He's also playing in Staten Island, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Salem, Mass., Norwood, Mass. Again, all the information about these should be over at stevenaive.com. If you're an Elvis Costello fan, you might want to check out WFMU.org/Michael, because my August 2020 chat with Bruce Thomas is there, and that's another two-hour program. That's a really long chat with Bruce and a bunch of related music. So that's over WFMU.org/Michael. All right, here it is, my chat. Very interesting guy, super nice guy, 16 solo albums, new albums about love. Here it is, me and Steve Naive. So there is some music featuring Steve Naive, and as I mentioned earlier, he is coming to our area. I just mentioned all those dates. Steve Naive, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be able to speak to you like this.
First question, what music were you listening to as a kid? What were your folks listening to when you were growing up?
Well, my parents had very varied musical tastes. I mean, they listened to weird things. At one point, my father was listening to Bruckner symphonies and things like that, classical music, but, you know, quite a severe form of classical music. My mother was more into the kind of pop music of the day. There was a very famous song on the radio called Bobby's Girl by Sandy Posey. Do you know that one?
No.
No. Well, that was responsible for my brother being called Robert because of that song, you know. Yeah. No, my mother used to love things like Dusty Springfield, and she bought me my first Beatles album, and I think that was a key thing. But I very swiftly started to collect my own albums as soon as I could afford to do such a thing. And it seemed like you could afford to do that kind of thing back in those days. But I also got a job at a record store once a week. I used to work at the local record store, and so that helped. They gave me a discount.
So how old would you have been working in that store?
I guess when I was working in the store, I must have been around 15. It was a part-time job.
And were you taking piano lessons?
Yeah, I began taking piano lessons when I was like 4 or 5 years old. I mean, the thing is, my youngest brother, I've got two brothers and two sisters. I'm the oldest. My youngest brother was born profoundly deaf, which meant that my mother had to spend a lot of time with him, taking him to see different doctors and things like that. And so I was often left with a neighbor who happened to have a piano. We didn't have a piano at home. And so it was my neighbor's piano that was the first piano that I got to play on. And she got me piano lessons quite early on, simply because it gave her the opportunity to go and do other things.
Mm. Were you one of those kids that just walked over to the piano and figured out something, you know, intuitively?
I think so, yeah. I think I've always been, you know, sort of self-taught rather than paying attention to the lessons that people were trying to give me. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So we go forward. I believe the story is that you were in college, and am I right? There was an ad, Elvis Costello or management had placed some ad looking for a band.
Yeah. I always wanted to be in a band, and I did join a few local bands and played with them for a little while. But there was a moment where I used to buy the New Musical Express and the Melody Maker. Those two papers were my two papers, and I would sit down and read them. And one day I remember sitting down in the refectory of the Royal College of Music, where I was supposed to be learning piano and composition. I sat down there looking through their adverts where people were asking, you know, for musicians to join different bands or whatever. And I came across two adverts. One was Stiff Records require a keyboard player for a rocking pop combo. And the other one, which I didn't actually go to, was I think the band Curved Air were looking for someone to play keyboards. So that's weird, right?
Yeah.
There were those two. And I went to the Stiff Records one. When I called them, they were trying to put people off because they'd had so many people calling up. And so the young lady on the other end of the line said to me, yes, we're putting together an Elvis Presley impersonator band in an attempt to put people off going, you know, but it didn't put me off. I decided to go all the same.
So how old were you when you answered that, when you made that call?
I think I was just turned 18.
Ah. And were you aware of My Aim Is True?
No, I wasn't, but I was given a copy of it shortly after. And I remember very well the sort of, you know, certain things that happen in your life give you sort of weird feelings. I don't know if it's deja vu or it's something, you know. And that was one of them, that album with that black and white squares on it, and just the way it sounded, the way Elvis sang on it. It's an album where his voice on that album is not like his voice on any other of his albums. Do you have this feeling?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it's like almost like a different human that made that album. It's a great album, and obviously I have listened to it many times, and I still enjoy listening to it very much.
Hmm. If I had asked you at age 18, who's your favorite band, what would you have said?
Well, I had several. I was a big Mark Bolan fan, and I was also an Alice Cooper fan. But I had a lot of records in my collection. I had John Lennon's solo albums. I did have Led Zeppelin albums in my collection, I believe. And I had weird things like John Taverner, The Whale. I remember I had that album. So, you know, because I was at college, so we were studying modern music. So I had a lot of those kind of things, Schoenberg albums. So I had a mixture of albums, yeah.
So through, I guess, these advertisements, the attractions were put together. So what was your first impression? Was the chemistry, musically at least, apparent right away?
Well, the first thing that we did was we went to Cornwall to a little farmhouse where they allowed us to set up in I think it was actually the village hall. And we sat up in there and just played through, I guess, all the songs of My Aim Is True and a few new songs. And everything sort of came together fairly easily. I don't think there was any racking of the brains, you know. It all kind of just came out as it did. But we did try a few different ideas out on certain songs until we found the way that we thought was going to be the way to do it, you know.
So how much rehearsal before the first gig?
My memory is not very, it's not a good one. I have a very bad memory. But I think we were there for a week. And then our first gig, we were the opening act for Jane County and the Electric Chairs, as I remember. And this was a moment where Wayne County had just become Jane County, I think. And for me, it was a weird experience because the other guys had all played in rock bands and done that kind of thing before. But for me, this was the first real moment of this kind of behavior. And so, you know, it was discovering what it was like to be in the dressing room area, the whole thing, you know. And I remember distinctly the moment of stepping out on the stage. And it was, it wasn't a massive arena or anything like that. It was a tiny little place. But the proximity of people in the audience to us really struck me. You know, you could touch the audience, you know what I mean? Mm. And so this was quite a startling moment for me. But, we started to do so many gigs that I quickly got used to it.
Yeah. Okay, I can imagine. It was completely mind-blowing, yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned that My Aim Is True has sort of a special place for you, because when I hear that record, you know, you can sort of only hear it or think of it now for me in retrospect, but I can imagine at the time, you know, if you had put a different cover on that with a less angry guy and, you know, if you had used a different name besides Elvis, you know, that record could have hinted at so many different directions. And I think it's such a signal of the time it came out that Elvis became very identified with a certain sort of attitude. Was that something that was palpable, you know, or did it, was, you know, something that organically evolved, just that, you know, the fact that he was not a dinosaur rock or a country rock or a punk rock, it was a whole new thing. Did you feel that?
Yes, I think so. I think that it's very difficult to say what kind of music that is, you know, but now that we know a little more about it and we know who played on it and why they played on it and everything like that. But a song like Allison, for example, coming out at the time that it did, you know, the words of Allison are incredible. It's an incredible song. And it's quite impossible to really know what that song is about, right? You can put your own idea into it, or Elvis might have done an interview where he might have explained it. But it fitted perfectly with imperfectly with what was going on at the time. It didn't sound like any of the other sort of high energy, horrible rock bands that were coming out at the time.
Yeah.
But it had a message, My Aim Is True. That was great, wasn't it? And it really influenced me to a big extent. You know, it changed my life, that song.
Mm. Amazing. Let's talk about the recording of this year's Model. For me, the sonic leap, as amazing as My Aim Is True is, the sonic leap between My Aim Is True and this year's Model might be the biggest leap in any artist's two LPs, you know, two sequential LPs. I mean, it's a mind-blowing record, I think. Did you guys recognize when you were making it, when you were listening to the mixes, you know, before people had heard it, did you realize that this was going to kind of jump forward leap years?
I don't know, but I think we were doing a lot of touring, so we were playing all the time, and mostly the songs that are on this year's Model would have been part of our set, so they would have become very under our belts, sort of thing, second nature almost. But there was a moment where we did go into a studio and just slam them all down in one afternoon as a sort of demo, not ever intending that that would be a release or anything like that, just for us, really. But I seem to remember that we did that. And then when we actually recorded this year's Model, it was done. You know, it wasn't something that took months and months to do. It was very quick. For me, it's one of my favorite albums that we've made. It's got such a sort of unique sound about it. And it is the sound of how we sounded, you know, even more than, you know, Armed Forces might have been, or you know. it was just a recording of what that group of people sounded like live, you know. So it was a great experience. It was the first time that I worked on an album, you know.
Mm.
Shortly after I met Elvis and became the keyboard player that was going to be in his band, they were finishing up watching the Detectives, which had been recorded with different people. I think the rhythm section of Graham Parker and the Rumour.
Yeah, Steve and Andrew, yeah.
Yeah. And so they wanted to add a little something to it, you know. So that was the first record that I ever played on watching the Detectives.
What a great one.
Yeah, what a great one to start with. And the weird thing is, when I grew up in this little town called Dartford, which is 20 miles outside London. It's a part of the outskirts of London where the Rolling Stones come from. They all grew up in Dartford, right? And the other peculiar thing about this part of the world is it's where the Vox factory was. So actually, the Vox organ that I had, I didn't realize it at the time when I had it, but it was a local product, you know, it came from that part of the world. You know, it ended up being the thing that I took in the studio and recorded on watching the Detectives, and then it ended up being the thing that's all over this year's model, you know.
Mm.
So this is quite, I think, quite extraordinary. And I can remember the day I got my first Vox organ. My dad took me to this house where someone had advertised that he was selling a Vox Jaguar, I think it was. And there you go. I had that. I played in a few bands with it, but then I joined the greatest band in the world, as far as I can see, the Attractions, with the same, the same thing.
I agree with you that this year's model is a document of how that band sounded, but it's somehow deeper than just a live record. You know, it's definitely a record that invites repeated listening in a way that maybe a purely live recording enough, but yet there's just so much of that live energy is still in. And you guys walk the line there. What is the band's state of mind or sobriety, perhaps we could call it? And was that a factor in the way that record sounds?
Well, that's a question. I think that one of the big factors of the way that record sound was the production team of Nick Lowe and his assistant Roger Bashirian.
Mm.
Those two people, they obviously had been to see us play. They knew who we were, and definitely Elvis and Nick Lowe had a history going back several years. But the pair of them sort of did such a good job on that record. My Vox organ, for example, there was a new machine that had come out called an Eventide Harmonizer. And I know for a fact that although they didn't tinker too much with what we were doing, the actual sound of the Vox organ is made more kind of seductive and gigantic by this machine that had probably only just come out. But the setting that Roger put on it, without that setting, it wouldn't have sounded like that, you know.
That's interesting. So
little details like that were crucial. And I think Nick Lowe has got such a great technique as a producer of getting people into a frame of mind and getting to what needs to be done for the song, you know. And I think that all the records that we made with Nick were made to be the best they could be because of him, because of his input, you know. Definitely, I would say, very important.
Yeah, I'm glad you call out Nick for his contributions. You know, it's funny because you mentioned that it's basically your first album, but Bruce and Pete especially had been playing on many recordings, you know, that predate their work with Elvis. And when you listen to that and then listen to their work on this year's model, you know, Bruce and Pete are both playing in ways they never played before. It's like a switch got turned. And so I do wonder, you know, was it just what was in the air? Was it what the songs demanded? Was it Nick? Was it Elvis? Was it drugs? Was it chemistry of all of you?
Well, I know that at the time we were on schedule of craziness, you know, like there were years where we did more gigs than there are days in the year, you know. And so I think we were used to sort of, there was a level of alcohol probably, and maybe some other substances involved. But I don't think those things are really what you could attribute to how that record turned out, you know. I think at that time, it was quite early on in the career, everything was still very under control. There wasn't any complete over-the-top intoxication going on or anything like that. Mm. No, I think it was the beginning of something. After a while, when you've done something more than once, you start to have thought processes and you start to think about what these think, what you're doing, you know. But I don't think that was really quite so happening at that time, you know. At that time, it was more intuitive and people just getting off on what was happening, you know. Because much later than that, we went through a whole load of things and then we stopped to work together. And then we came back for an album called Brutal Youth. And at that point, although Nick was there, he was taking over the job of playing the bass, right?
Right.
And there was another producer involved, and the record doesn't sound anything like anything that we ever did with Nick. But that other producer...
Mitchell Froom, right?
That's it, yeah. A great keyboard player, great producer, actually. He's produced some of my favorite records. At some point, he realized that it was his job as a producer to get the missing link back, you know. And somehow, he persuaded Elvis to invite Bruce to come in. And what you were just talking about happened as soon as Bruce walked in the door and picked up the bass and we did a track with Bruce on the bass. It was a completely different animal.
Hmm.
It was not the same thing that we had just been recording with Nick on the bass. It just went, I don't know, 20 times bigger than you can imagine, you know. And so that was great that Mr. Froom managed to get that to happen, I think. And it led on to a few more tracks and a few more really good moments on stage. And so it was good.
Yeah, I mean, I personally love that album. Yeah, that's fascinating. So, again, you're 19 or maybe at around this time. Things were moving fast for you. I guess you'd never known that life wasn't supposed to be 300 gigs a year and, you know, 400 motels and living in a van and making, you know, over one album a year. Is that right? Did you understand how abnormal a life this was?
I think we took it all in our stride in a certain way. I mean, probably between Elvis and the management and that, there were plans being made and followed and blueprints and things like that. But for us guys who were just the band, we just followed whatever the story was, and it was exciting. And, you know, it was an adventure, the adventure of a lifetime.
Yeah. When I interviewed, I spoke with Bruce Thomas, I don't know, a couple of years ago. And, you know, I said something like, so you guys are recording, you know, and does Elvis say to you, oh my God, your bass playing is blowing everyone's mind, you know? And the same thing goes for you and the same thing goes for Pete. And I think what Bruce said was like, no one ever said that. We just sort of went ahead and did our jobs, which to me sort of seems crazy mind-blowing. So what's your perspective on that? Did you guys take a minute to appreciate how fantastic you were at the time?
I don't know if we did that. I think we definitely, when we were making albums, you would do the take and someone would have to decide if that was the take or not. So you had to review a little bit your work. But at that moment, it was always... It would always have nothing to do with my work. So, you know, a great take could involve something that I knew was better on a previous take as far as the keyboards were concerned. But I think that's an important part of being in a band, you know, because you have to be able to say, okay, well, they're going to go with that take and I know why they're going to go with that take and it will end up being the better take. Even though I played a funny note on that one and I didn't play it on the one before. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
I read a quote from Nick Lowe who said something like, Steve Naive is very hard to produce because every take you play something brilliant. Like you're just playing a million great ideas, and they had to sort of, especially in the early days, get you to like understand you've got to play, you know, going into the chorus, you've got to play the same hook every time, you know, that there was sort of a learning curve for you.
There's something happening to me at the moment because I live in France, so I work with different French artists. And there's an artist that who I love very much. He writes some brilliant songs, and I've been working with him for a while. And we made an album. There's a very famous writer in France called Leo Ferry. Maybe you've heard of this guy. Anyway, his son has found something like 30 songs that have not seen the light of day. And he's sort of entrusting me and my friend Callie to maybe do this job. But the problem is, as he says, you know, these songs are written down on paper, and whoever does this job has got to stick rigidly to the paper, which is sort of like something that I've never been able to do. You know, I've always, once I start to learn a song, each time I play it, I try to inject some sort of emotion that I'm feeling at that time into it, which obviously this project would not work if it was like that. So I've got to say to myself, can I do this? Can I receive these 30 songs on paper, and can I play them precisely what is written? Because that's what the project has to be.
Mm.
So I'll keep you posted on that one.
It's a challenge. It will be a challenge, yeah. So Armed Forces, Get Happy, Trust, enough B-sides for a 20-track compilation called Taking Liberties here in the USA. You mentioned it, you alluded to it earlier. I mean, how did Elvis Costello do it? Did you see it happening? I mean, he was just churning out a ridiculous amount of songs. Was he doing it 24 hours a day? Did he do it during sound checks? And did it blow your mind?
Yes, it did. I can remember seeing him all the time with a hardback notebook in his hand, and we'd sit on a plane and he would be writing in his book. That's one of the weird things, is that since mobile phones and computers have arrived, obviously he now writes probably on his computer. And so that's something I don't see anymore. But my memory of him in those days was a guy who always had his notebook with him, you know.
Not just writing lots of songs, but writing lots of good songs is a harder trick.
Yes.
I read that you didn't like working on Get Happy. Of course, I read that on the internet, so perhaps it's not true. But is that true?
I think Get Happy took a little time to do, and, you know, it coincided with a sort of epoch where the intoxication levels had gone into the red, and there was suddenly this idea that we should go and record in Holland, in this sort of studio complex that was like... I think it was part of a TV studio complex. So we were dragged off to this place that I really didn't like to be there. I wanted to go home because I'd just become a dad and I had little children that I wanted to see. So there was probably a little bit of that in it, because it seemed like we were just, you know, going over, re-recording the same song, maybe trying to do it. I think there's quite a few outtakes of tracks on that album where you can see that we were experimenting with the arrangement a lot.
Yeah.
And rearranging certain things, like that song B-Movie that had several versions to it. You know, I just had to escape. Because for me, the album had already been done, you know.
Mm. When it came time to record songs that had not had the luxury of being worked up live, you know, because I assume some songs would get introduced at the beginning of a tour and then recorded at the end of the tour, but sometimes I know songs got worked up in the studio. So what is the process? What came from the musicians and what came from Elvis? How much of the, I guess, arranging came from you guys? And was it ideas, or was it just working up jamming in the studio?
I don't know. I mean, specific songs probably you could find. There must be tapes somewhere of other ways of playing them. But, I mean, a good example would be the song Somewhere in the Distance I Can Hear Who Shot Sam.
Motel Matches.
Yeah, Motel Matches. I had a piano part. And for some reason, when we first started recording it, it was not working. And, you know, because sometimes an arrangement just doesn't work because there's one or two elements in it that are not fitting that particular day. But I got very upset about that, and I'm pretty sure that if you could get hold of the master tape of that song and solo the piano, you would actually probably hear me crying a few times on the take, because I was so upset that they were going to abandon it.
Oh.
That I forced them to do it, let's just do it one more time like this, please, you know. And then we got the take, you know. So there's quite a few moments like that, I think, on recordings. Recordings are great because they are recordings of that particular second of time, of that moment of time. Possibly playing exactly the same arrangement on a different day, you wouldn't get the take. It's just the magic of the moment, you know.
Yeah, I think for Elvis fans, all those outtakes and B-sides are fascinating because you do get to see that the key to a song could be the piano part or a different feel on the drums, or, you know, you never know where it's going to come from. It is fascinating. So I think also 1980 is the album Mad About the Wrong Boy. The Attractions make their solo album, working with Roger Bashirian. So what were the expectations of that project? Was it, this will be fun, or it's like, we may have some new pop stars on our hands? What was it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm looking back on that time for various reasons. You know, I was often writing stuff myself, and so I wanted to make a record of my stuff. But due to the process and the band dynamic, it sort of got into this thing of, okay, it's going to be an Attractions album. Well, that meant that there was going to be a Bruce Thomas track and a Pete Thomas track. And then, of course, it also meant that any possibility of us doing any live stuff was slightly weird because we'd be the Attractions, you know. So it was, you know, it was a good project at the time through sort of ignorance, really, and through me not really, I didn't really prepare myself for what I wanted to do. I was just too involved in being an attraction, I think, for that to work out, you know.
Mm.
And of course, as soon as it came out, it had the unfortunate timing of coming out the same week that Graham Parker and the Rumours Band put out their album. And so, you know, the whole thing turned into a sort of media story about how people that are supporting great artists should not be making their own records, you know what I mean? So, you know, that rather dampened me for a little while, but not completely.
No, you've made, I think, 16 solo records over the years. So am I right that you wrote Straight Jacket and Arms Race? Is that correct? And are you singing those songs?
That is correct, yeah. Yeah, I wrote those songs. I wrote some of the songs I wrote with the woman I was a partner with at the time. So we co-wrote some songs together. And then some of the songs like Arms Race and Straight Jacket, I think, are songs that I wrote by myself.
It's interesting to hear you sing. The album Trust, lots and lots of piano, and again, sonically, just another real leap forward. Was the sound, as the band was going into a new project, was the sound discussed, or was it dictated by the songs and just sort of, it just happened, or was it like, let's try to make Trust sound a certain way?
I don't know. Did we achieve a different sound on it? Maybe we did.
Yeah, I definitely think there is just a sort of a deepness to it, a sort of a a heaviness to it, maybe, you know, and I don't know where that comes from. Yeah. All right. 1982, Imperial Bedroom. Yeah. After you go off to Nashville and record Almost Blue, 1982, you do Imperial Bedroom. You've split with Nick Lowe here, and Geoff Emerick, who, you know, of course, worked with the Beatles. What a pleasant surprise that record is. I remember as a, you know, I guess I was in high school listening to that record, and it took me, it was the first Elvis record that maybe took me a couple of listens, right? At first I was like, I don't know if I like this thing. And then all of a sudden I just was loving it. You know, it was kind of blowing my mind. Was it a nice surprise for you to sort of break out of the mold of making those records the same way?
Yes. You know, Geoff Emerick was a fantastic musical person to be around, and who definitely was capable of producing some sounds from things by his the way he used the gear and the microphones and everything. So it was wonderful from that point of view. It was also an album where we got to expand the palette of the Sonics by using you know, I did some orchestrations for Elvis for that album. And, you know, we had French horns and all sorts of things. At one point we had an electric harpsichord in the studio. You know, and we were in Air Studios. So it was the first time we'd recorded in a different studio, I think. Air Studios is Paul McCartney's studio right in the middle of London in Oxford Circus. So you're you know, up in the air with windows overlooking the most busiest street in London while you're working. So it's great, a great atmosphere up there. And a couple of times McCartney and George Martin were around. I'm sure you might already know the story that they invited George Martin to take a look at some of my scores for Imperial Bedroom, and he sort of... I did this weird thing where I decided not to have any violins, only violas. And so he saw that and he was like, oh, that's a bit strange. But when we did, what was it? I'm the Town Crier, the orchestra is all violas and no violins.
I was listening earlier to the score And in Every Home. So, you know, it's quite an amazing piece of music. How long does it take? Did it take you to write that score?
Well, it was in the days before we had computers of any kind. I mean, we might have had an Atari computer or something like that. So I got the George Emerick to give me the backing tracks. And I took them home and just had a keyboard at home with sort of almost the, you know, with this different sounds on it that I basically worked out what I was going to write out and then wrote it out. And that was it. It was done the old fashioned way, shall we say. But it was a great experience for me. I loved it. And I would love to do more arrangements.
I think in the liner notes, Elvis says that he wishes he had a film of you conducting the orchestra, yeah.
This is the crazy thing, is that we didn't have mobile phones, and so we didn't have cameras with us all the time. And a lot of those moments just went by without any sort of documentation, you know. I mean, I got to play keyboards with David Bowie one time on the song Absolute Beginners. And there is absolutely nothing. No, there is no visual record of this moment. I think one guy, the guitarist, managed to remember to bring a camera and get a picture of himself with David Bowie, you know. But that's it.
Yeah, times have changed. Yeah. Yeah.
Times have changed. Yeah. Yeah.
So from Imperial Bedroom to Punch the Clock, once again, it is like a whiplash situation sonically and the song structures. And you please correct me if I'm wrong. I always sort of figured that was Elvis's sort of, not his last gasp, but it was a gasp at trying to have a hit, trying to have a song that sounded more in the contemporary vein, certainly more contemporary than Imperial Bedroom. So my question is that correct? And was there pressure on the organization, on Elvis Costello and the Attractions, to have more hit records? Was that important to Elvis?
I don't know how important that was to Elvis, actually, but I do think that the people that produced those records were very successful and were having hit records. So it wasn't like we're going to put you in the studio with John Cale, who's going to do something weird. You know, they definitely put us in the studio with people who were supposed to be good at that kind of thing. You know, and also they were people that were kind of close to us in a way. They had had a huge success with bands like Madness and other people. But I suppose, you know, it wasn't like we were going anywhere, really. Clive Langer was managed, I think, by the same person that managed Elvis. So it seemed like a logical choice to work with Clive. And I think that working with Clive was interesting it did coincide with this whole sort of aspect of music being changed by the technology, of which we weren't really part of that because we didn't embrace it at all. But the production team had obviously embraced it a little bit. And so certain things were happening that for them it was better if we followed their expertise, you know. And we did. I liked working with Clive because, certain things that he did, I think, were maybe on hindsight burying slightly the message of the song.
Mm.
And that we could have stepped back from that a little bit, maybe. But I guess you're right, you know, there was pressure from certain quarters to produce something that could get on the radio. And the radio had changed its nature, and it was now a radio full of a certain kind of music that if you weren't playing in time with a metronome, you probably wouldn't get played on the radio.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's interesting. It is the beginning of a huge change. There's Goodbye Cruel World, and then Elvis tours a little bit solo, and these are kind of the first cracks in the system, sort of. And you get some time off, and you play with a ton of people, with Squeeze and with Graham Parker and with Kirsty MacColl, who I love, and with Madness and David Bowie and Nick Hayward. Did it feel in some ways nice to, you know, because you'd had one job since you were 18 years old, did it feel nice to stretch your wings a bit?
Yeah, I think there were some things. For instance, every time someone asked you to play on a record, you'd be going to a different studio with a different producer, and you would learn things that you wouldn't have learned inside the team. I mean, working with Steve Lillywhite was an amazing experience because he had a whole completely different sort of system than I'd ever come across, you know. He set the studio up so that everything was sounding as it would do on the record, and everything was already sort of produced, if you see what I mean. And everybody that was going to be on it was there and had to play it. But it just, when you put your headphones on, it was the finished record. It was amazing. I think the first time that I had that experience, you know.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So the mix was already finished.
It wasn't just a balance, you know. It was a mix with all the effects and everything sounding just right, you know. It was great. I remember that.
1985, you play keyboards on Dancing in the Street with David Bowie and Mick Jagger. Is it possible that you were in the studio same time as they were?
No, they were both there. So it was a fantastic day. And that was the thing working with Clive. He had a studio called West Side Studios that were constantly different people coming in. And so during that period, he was calling me and asking me to come down and play on this, come down and play on that. So I played on many, many records during that period in his studio. And they were making the film of Absolute Beginners, the film, and we were supposed to record the title song with David Bowie. We did the backing track for that song, and then David Bowie said, I've got someone coming down a bit later, and we're going to record something special. And so then they told us that we would be recording with Mick Jagger dancing in the street, right? It was such a great vibe. So, we listened to different versions of it, and then we thought, well, how are we going to do this, and blah, blah, blah. And we started playing down the song in the studio, and all of a sudden the door opened, and Mick Jagger came strutting in, right? And, you know, started like doing the full Mick Jagger in front of all of us, so that he whipped the music up in, you know, yeah. It went up about 10 gears. Like, you know, it was incredible. And then he did that for a little while until it really got going. And they said, okay, okay. And then, and that was it. Then the red light came on, sort of thing. It was an amazing day. And then the two of them, David Bowie and Mick Jagger, sat down to listen. You know, they each went and overdubbed their vocals separately. But then they had this listening session to decide. I think they did two takes each, I think. And it was a question of, was it take one or take two both times, you know? And I have a completely different memory of this than somebody else that was there who told me something completely different. So it's weird. I think that things can happen to you and you can see it from a certain angle and then someone else can see it from another angle. Yeah. But I seem to remember that when they were listening back to Mick Jagger's vocal, and both takes were extraordinary, you know, and brilliant, they would play take A, then they would play take B of just, you know, two lines, and someone like Clive would say, yeah, I think take A is the good take. And so Mick Jagger would go, okay, we'll use take B. And it was like every time someone wanted one take, he wanted the other take. Mm. It was really funny. But both takes were great, so it didn't really make much difference.
Ah, what a wonderful moment.
Yeah, it was just the sort of attitude of Mick Jagger to say, no, we'll take the other one.
Around the same time Elvis is doing King of America, which mostly does not have the attractions, and I think the press always sort of reported that you guys just weren't happy not knowing what your place was in the Elvis universe. 86 also, same year, Blood and Chocolate, his 11th record in, you know, 10 years. I think that's an amazing record, and perhaps some of that tension is in the recording, and you're back with Nick Lowe, of course, for that record. And that's, I guess, when you were doing the tour with, he was doing those tour with several nights in a city with different bands and stuff like that. I, you know, you're still with Elvis, so obviously things have worked out, but I assume that there was some tension during that time. And do you love Blood and Chocolate as much as I do?
We love tension as well. No, but we love tension, and we do love Blood and Chocolate. But at the time, making that record was actually, how can I say, it was very difficult to make that album. And I think that everybody that was involved with it would say the same thing, right?
Hmm.
We set up in the studio as if we were doing a live gig. So we had all our monitors and our amps, and we were loud, right? Much louder than you should be. And we had no headphones. And the idea was that even though the sound was, you know, my sound was going to go all over the bass was going to go all over the guitar, we were going to just accept that because we were only going to do one or two takes of each song, and that had to be it. There was a sort of weird vibe in a way, because we were not going into the studio and talking and being friendly with each other. We were just waiting until Elvis showed up, played us the song maybe once or twice, and then that was it. You had to sort of just get through it. It was most peculiar, you know. But it did produce quite an album.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I listen to it, I sort of wish we could have had a little bit more time on some of the songs.
Mm.
But, you know, it wouldn't have had the same sort of emotion to it if we had done that, you know. Because we'd all played together for so long by that point that we could get away with that a little bit, maybe. But when you listen to a song like Poor Napoleon, if you really listen to it, you can sort of hear that we're not quite sure where the song goes, you know.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying?
But in some ways, that's what, you know, you run out of tricks on how to keep albums fresh. And I guess the trick of all being uncomfortable is one that you had not used, you know, previously for better or worse.
Exactly. Uncomfortableness. We haven't tried that. Let's give that a go.
Yeah, genius. So Elvis goes on and he makes, you know, Spike, Mighty Like a Rose, Juliet Letters, etc. Some of those you participate in a little bit. And then he's back in 94 with Brutal Youth, which you talked about a little bit earlier. What, you know, again, like to me, that and Blood and Chocolate are sort of a pair in a way. I do love that record. And you mentioned Nick Lowe's bass playing, which I think is fantastic. Although you're right, there is such a huge difference between the way he and Bruce play. Can you talk about what makes Pete Thomas such an incredible, and I will use the word musician, not just drummer. He's an incredible musician.
Yes, he is. And I think he totally lives the Elvis sort of voyage. When he brings to each song is remarkable. It's not just a drum beat, you know, it's the whole sort of basis of the world of that song is Pete Thomas. I think as the years have gone by, he's sort of distilled his style, distilled it so much that it's so strong. It's really an essential part of the sound of Elvis Costello, I think.
Yeah. Well, also like you, he plays with a very personal style, yet he also fits it to the song, you know, which is an amazing trick to do both of those. So 96, All This Useless Beauty with Jeff Emerick again, and then 98, Painted for Memory with Bacharach that you mentioned earlier. So what did you learn from you know, being in the same room as Burt Bacharach? And did he appreciate your gifts? Because you're such different types of keyboard players.
Yes, we probably are. I think he did. He certainly, you know, we made that album with him, and that was a wonderful experience and everything. And it, at some moment, it was a very difficult album because, you know, he's looking for a feel that is so difficult to find, you know, that... That can be, yeah. I think there was a song. Which song was it? Probably it was the song Painted from Memory. Ding, 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 ding. Caused us a lot of problems when we came to record it. You know, we just couldn't get it to sit right. And we thought we had, and Bert would come on the intercom saying, no, start again. You know, so he was a perfectionist of. Mega proportions, and the best memory I have of Bert actually was when he came back. I think it was on the Look Now album. He played on a couple of tracks on that. So right at the beginning of that album, the first thing we did was did a session. We did a whole afternoon with Bert playing grand piano, and I played organ with the Impostors, and that was a wonderful thing. I think that the Painted from Memory was slightly different. It was all different session men, and so it made it slightly different, you know. I enjoyed the Look Now sessions much more because Pete was there, and Bert was great on that. You know, he was really, he really played along with our band sort of thing, whereas when we did Painted from Memory, it was like we were playing along with his band.
crucial difference there, yeah. So 2002.
A slight difference.
Yeah. Davey Farragher joins the band. And, you know, there was this idea that the attractions were broken up and you were kind of in and out of Elvis's world. Was there any hesitation to sort of go back on your part? Did you ever think, maybe I need to just divorce myself from this?
I think I was very upset when the attractions came. So the first time we ended, it definitely caused me to have quite an important emotional breakdown that involved me having to go into hospital and certain things happened in my life that maybe wouldn't have happened if we hadn't have stopped at that moment. but we did. But then, as chance would have it, I became the musical director of a TV show called The Last Resort. And the result of that was that every week, band that I put together on that TV show was playing with different artists. And so it was an incredible moment. It went on for several years. And so we even played behind James Brown on that show.
What fun.
So, you know, so that was incredible. We had Roy Orbison came on. I mean, so many great moments. So, you know, we did a whole show with Paul McCartney, who was so wonderful. And he invited me and my band to go and stay at his house so that we could rehearse a few extra days with him. That was great. There were some really good moments. That was good. And at the same time as that happened, I started to work in France with a French artist called Alain Chamfort, who, outside of France, you might not have heard of him, but he's like the Brian Ferry of France, I suppose. But I ended up doing 3, 4, 5 years of touring with him, just the two of us. So it was like a duo show. And, you know, he wrote songs with Serge Gainsbourg. So he's got, there's a lot of songs where Serge Gainsbourg wrote the words and Alain Chamfort wrote the music. And his music is not like our English-American music. It's really more linked to something like Debussy or Ravel. It's a very French chord sequences and elaborate harmonies that are just wonderful. And so this was great. Then I met my future partner, Muriel. She was the metteur en scène for Alain Chamfort. She devised the whole show, in fact. It was called Chanson pour quatre mains, songs for four hands, because we both had, he had a like Fender Rhodes piano and I had a gigantic grand piano. And that was it. That was the music.
So when you go from being in the hospital, from this thing ending to it sort of getting mended and coming back together, did that involve talking and figuring and, you know, and sort of patching it up and trying to achieve understanding, or did you just start back up?
No, it was nothing to do with anybody except me. And it was my, a lot of being in a band and being in the rock and roll world is about abusing yourself, you know, and eventually you have to come to terms with it and stop it. And the stopping of it is a process that different people choose different ways of tackling that, you know. And I don't know that I have tackled it the best it could be tackled. But I've sort of dealt with it by myself. And I know that, you know, a lot of people in this music world and also in other worlds have joined the AA, which does amazing things for people, and I think it's great. But for me, the sort of necessity to be in groups of people frightened me. I couldn't deal with that. And so I couldn't really take part in that. But I know that that is a very good thing, and that for some people that works really well, you know?
I'm happier in a better place. I think that's the important outcome.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk about The River in Reverse and Alan Toussaint, sort of like Burt Bacharach, just a complete genius. I mean, that guy has so much music in him. I mean, there's very few people who can rival Elvis Costello in just the amount of output and the amount of good output. Just an amazing style, piano player, great songwriter, such a talented guy. Tell me what you learned from him.
I have to, you know, I have to thank deeply Elvis for, you know, making these adventures that take us towards people like that, you know, because the chance of meeting someone like Burt Bacharach or Alan Toussaint is just such a great thing to have, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't really say enough about about Bert, but you know, when you listen to Bert's music and you see something and you hear the things that he's done and the things that he's written, it's incredible. You know, it's not like anybody else, is it? I mean, it's mind blowing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when it comes to Alan Toussaint, it's the same thing, but maybe for me, even more so, because Alan was so willing to share his knowledge and stuff. He was such a great person. And, you know, we did so many things together. We did some tours where my Hammond organ was on a riser above his piano, so I could just sit there playing the organ, looking down and seeing what he was up to, you know, because when I listen to him, I think, how the hell does he do that? You know, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And so it was great to be able to see it so close. You know, the first time we worked with Alan Toussaint, we made a record of Yoko Ono's song, Walking on Thin Ice. And Elvis said, I'll only do it if Alan Toussaint will produce it, right? And so, and this was a long time before the River in Reverse, we got to go to New Orleans to Alan Toussaint's studio and be produced. And it was at a time when we had, I don't know what album it was, but one of the albums that we did with Clive had horn section on it. So we were touring around with a horn section. And Alan Toussaint incorporated that into the arrangement. But it's the only time that I've been in the studio to record something. And the producer, Alan Toussaint, come to each musician and said, now this is what I want you to play. And showed you. Mm. Actually did it, you know. So he took the bass, he took the Elvis's... He knew exactly what had to go down on this record, you know. And it was great. It was just completely different from anything I'd ever experienced.
That's fascinating, yeah.
Yeah, it was. And because he could play all the instruments, and he's got such an amazing catalogue of songs that he's written that's beyond anything that I think I've ever seen of anybody. It's really amazing, isn't it? I mean,
I agree. He's underrated as an American songwriter. It's just incredible.
People don't realize that they've heard, you know, they've heard his songs. You know?
Yeah, partly. He's so such a humble guy. I think that has something to do with it. Yeah,
he had such a beautiful speaking voice. And, you know, when he wasn't happy with something that was going down in the studio, he would just say, Steve, that called in the middle of that. What do you think about that? when you heard him say, "What do you think about that?" You knew what he was saying was, "Do you think you could do something different there?" You know,
his code for
it was just the way he put it. It was great. You know,
yeah, that's funny. Yeah. So Momofuku, National Ransom, Look Now, Hey Clockface, A Boy Named If, and a lot more. Elvis sort of, he slowed down a little bit, but he's still remarkably prolific out there. Is it, so when you guys go out to play a tour, you know, there's now, I don't know how many, 500, 1,000 songs that you've played on. How do you keep them all in your head? Do you keep them all in your head? And does he kind of cull them down and says, we're going to play these 100 or these 50 for this next tour?
I don't know, but I think that when people do something for over the years, they keep doing it, they keep doing it, they keep doing it. What happens is they get better at it and they learn things about it. And so I think that we still haven't arrived, but we're sort of getting to a new point now, because I think Elvis has understood some new things about the construction of a concert, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that he puts a concert together now is not like it was 10 years ago, you know. It's completely different, and I'm not going to say what it's about, but the way he constructs it now, it always used to be, this is a story that we're telling, you know, and we're going from the beginning of the story to the end of the story. But now it's something even more than that. because he's also thinking about, you know, he gets involved now in everything, every aspect of the concert, the lighting, the everything, you know. So it's interesting. And like you say, there's so many different eras and different songs to choose from. I'm quite excited about this next tour that we're doing, which has the subtitle of The Early Songs of Elvis Costello. But I can't tell you more about it than that because I don't want to spoil the surprises.
Fair enough, but do you have to go back and relearn some songs that you haven't played in 10, 20, 30, 50 years?
There are some songs in the list that we have never played before.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there are songs that we didn't play so often that I had to go back to look inside them, yeah. What's great nowadays, though, is the computer has got this new capability of stripping a song into various stems, which means that you can turn certain members of the band off and hear other members more clearly, you know.
I guess that's a helpful tool. Tell me about your stage setup. I believe you have guitar pedals in part of your rig, and how many keyboards are you using these days?
Well, one thing is I want to keep inside my rig the original rig, if you see what I mean. So the original rig was just the Vox Continental and a very cheap sort of piano keyboard, electric piano, right? And I always thought it was this thing called an Insta piano. I'm sure at some point it was what is known as the Insta piano, but trying to find one of those, you'd never find one, you know, except maybe on eBay or something. And then someone sent me a photo and said, the piano on top of the Vox is actually a Roland electric piano. And I managed to track it down. And so now I have this as the sort of centerpiece of my rig. I think that maybe on this tour, this needs to be brought forward. But I don't know if it will be because it might be too disruptive to do that. Because you need to be able to get access to all the other things, you know. So I've got that. And then I've got a sort of, you know, very modern 88, so it's the length of a piano keyboard, which is connected to a computer which can make any sound that you want it to make. So you've basically got everything covered there.
Hmm.
At one point, I used to have my Vox organ balanced on top of a Hammond organ, so that was a bit over the top. But now I've got this Hammond organ that's not actually a Hammond organ, but it sounds great. It sounds like a perfect Hammond organ, because the Hammond organ doesn't like touring. It doesn't travel very well.
Mm.
And so this thing seems to work better.
So am I right, there are guitar pedals involved in the rig?
Yes, so I was putting the Vox organ, and I used to use the Pianettes, which were very popular at a certain point. And so I was using a Pianette and putting it through lots of different guitar pedals. But then when I got rid of the Pianette, I kept the guitar pedals to put my Vox organ through. But it's very dangerous for the other members of the entourage. So I don't mess with that too much anymore. But I do have some delays, I think. Delay echoes that can be quite nice.
Gotcha. Yeah, so this summer, let's get to now. This summer, you're coming to our area, to the East Coast, for
yes,
a rare tour without Elvis. And I think this all stems from when the pandemic happened. You and another French, or a guy who was in France near you, this musician called Casada, you did this series of nightly Instagram and Facebook and internet concerts where you would just play live music. And I think you did over 100 of them, if I'm right. And so this idea
exactly
to bring this now to tour, and you've got a new record called About Love, which is very interesting and has John Denver and Fountains of Wayne and Elvis Costello covers. And so you'll be doing this sort of, you'll be bringing this thing to the world, and you're going to be in New York City and Shelter Island and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and Salem, Mass, and Norwood, Mass. How interesting. It must be such a change to not go out with Elvis and to do, will you be doing any of the singing yourself, or is Casada doing all the singing?
The lockdown concerts that I did with Casada were, to begin with, we started doing them every night, and we would basically get up in the morning, have breakfast, and try to imagine what our set would be. So each one was completely different, you know, and sometimes we would just choose a theme and we would do it like that. Anyway, this particular event, we called it the Immobile Tour because we couldn't go anywhere. So we were the Immobile Tour. So what we're doing now is we're bringing the Immobile Tour to the East Coast this time. And then I think later in the year, maybe in November, we're going to do a few more East. I'm hoping to play at the Carlisle Room in New York, maybe towards the end of the year, like in November. And then we are going to go over to the West Coast and do it down that way. But the sort of theme is about love, because we feel that given what's happening in the world around us at the moment, this is a very important message and subject that we all want to talk about. So about love, and we're sharing the singing, but obviously he's doing more singing than I am, but I am singing a few of my songs. He's singing a few of his songs, and in between that, we are singing some songs that the Immobile Tour fans chose as their favourites. And the overall thing is about love.
Hmm. I know that folks can go look at the tour dates over at stevenaive.com. Yeah, you know, there's some, singing is very charming. There's the 2014 record you put out together, and there are some real charming duets. So I'm quite curious to hear you singing live. There's something else on your website, stevenaive.com, called Give Me Five Notes, where you folks have the opportunity to pluck five notes on a keyboard that's on the website, and then you will write a song just for them around those five notes. Yeah. How often does someone take you up on that offer?
Well, it's not a new thing, because I did do that whenever I did live shows of my own. That was one of the things that I did in my show. But the thing on the website is my first attempt at computer coding. So I've managed to code the entire page myself. I made the samples of the keyboard, which you can play, and you choose your five notes. It's not exactly perfect yet, but it's my first attempt at coding, so I'm glad you picked up on it.
That's fascinating.
Yes, but the five notes is, we'll probably do that in these concerts that we're doing, where we try to, you know, we play songs, we play our songs to the audience, and at some point we ask the audience to select five notes, so we play their music, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, that sounds exciting, and a little bit of a tightrope walk. So yes. What is your, you know, this is literally almost 50 years of touring. Here you are going at again with Casada. You clearly are doing this because you love it. I assume that's the number one reason, because you feel the need to communicate this music. So what is your touring routine, and how do you keep sane?
How do I keep sane? Well, I don't know, because when I'm not touring with Elvis, I'm doing some touring in France with French singers that I love. Mm. And it just seems to be part of the life that that I lead, that I really like. It's not necessarily touring like we do, where it's a, you know, you go for a month or something. I mean, I quite like it when it's a couple of days, and then you come back, and then you go for a couple of more days like that. I like making music, and I like playing with people. I've really enjoyed working with Casada, because he's a younger guy, and he's got different music that he likes. And so he shares that with me. That helps to keep me on my toes. Also, the way he does things now, it's funny how you are a sort of product of your time a little bit. And the times are a-changing, as Mr. Dylan says. And so you can learn a lot of stuff from young people.
Are there songs that you look forward to playing live the most?
Yes, many of them. I mean, there are no songs that I don't look forward to playing.
Yeah, that's incredible attitude, yeah.
I would say. I mean, I love it when we do you know, long tours, and then, you know, after 4 or 5 weeks, we start to think, wouldn't it be good to... What's great about Elvis is he never sticks to the same set, you know, and it's quite challenging, but it's fantastic, you know. I mean, we did that tour once with The Wheel, with all the song titles on it.
Right.
Spinning. Whatever comes up, you've got to play it. Once you've done that, you know, you realise that the set list doesn't actually... It does matter, because when you can construct a show with some sort of sense behind it, then that makes a lot of difference. But you could actually just do a random set and it would have a sense behind it just by chance, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I saw some of those Wheel shows. They were fun. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and a lot of dates coming up on the East Coast, starting in mid-July in Stony Brook. And check out stevenaive.com for information and information about all of your work and ongoing stuff that you're up to, and this new release with Quesada about love. Thank you so much. This has been so fascinating, and we appreciate you visiting with us this morning.
Thank you. It was a pleasure speaking to you, and I hope that I was able to tell you something you didn't already know, because you know almost everything.
Drowning.